Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 18 of the Brown County Hour. This is Janice Pierce.
And this is Dave Seastrom. Here at the start of our fourth year, we begin a monthly production, airing the first Sunday of each month at 9 a.m.
We have a great show for you this morning, with a lot of stories about things that go thump in the woods. In the first segment of this episode, we have Dave Seastrom, Keith Bradaway, who's a member of the local writers group Raps, and violinist Carolyn Dutton. Stay tuned for later in the show. We hear from Gunther Flum, Cassie Norman, Charlie Cole and Linda Baden, Tramp Star, Peggy Daly, and John Kay.
Hi, this is Dave Seastrom of the Brown County Hour. Here in Brown County, we share the woods with many a fine critter. Our animal kingdom encompasses everything from the majestic deer to the diminutive salamander, and quite truthfully, not all of our friends in the wood can be considered benign. Our nights are often filled with exotic sounds. Some are haunting, and others are downright frightening. When the coyotes gather, they begin a chorus of unearthly cries. As various groups call out to one another, you might mistake them for aliens or hordes of marauders coming to take you away. Many a moonless night has found the wary listener wondering if they need to grab Grandpa's shotgun and make ready for the attack. Squeals and chirps and barks fill the night air, and somewhere in all that darkness, the mystery of just who is it that's making those sounds can excite the imagination with anything you're willing to envision. The call of the vixen fox comes to mind. For all the world, this animal love call sounds like a woman being murdered. I have it on good authority that the local police were called out to address what several neighbors described as a horrible crime being committed. A lonely officer showed up at the scene, and surrounded by darkness, he was completely surprised to hear a blood-curdling scream coming from down in the bottom of a deep ravine. Gun drawn, crouched down, the officer frantically called for backup. When another officer showed up with an infrared night viewing device, much to their relief, they could make out the vixen as she scurried away. And then we have our venomous neighbors. And I'm not talking about political or religious differences. From toxic arachnids to poisonous vipers, the high deserts and deep jungles have nothing on us. The brown recluse and the black widow are amongst our most secretive and potentially harmful cohabitants. These wily critters can be found just about anywhere the sun don't shine. It's a practiced hand that learns not to reach under something without first having a good look. A simple walk through a grassy area can introduce you to one of our local favorites, the deer tick. Small in stature, they nonetheless can deliver a powerful punch. The regular woods tick is bad enough, and finding one implanted somewhere on your body is never welcome. However, these little bloodsuckers carry Lyme disease, and this is nothing to fool with. Speaking of grassy encounters, I'm not even going to mention the extreme discomfort of chiggers. For us, up here on the ridge, surrounded by miles of uninterrupted forest, the most intriguing and disconcerting neighbors are the poisonous snakes. Long about high summer, the serpents are on the move. Brought forth by their biological imperative, they must eat and mate in order to survive. During this time of year, it behooves the woods dweller to keep a wary eye out for what is quite literally the snake in the grass. Our particular vipers are rattlesnakes and copperheads, and in our neck of the woods, we see plenty of them. I happen to prefer the rattlesnakes. They're huge and beautiful and are completely non-aggressive. Many times over the years, I've inadvertently come way too close, only to be warned away by the frantic song of the rattle perched at the tail end of a surprisingly large snake. Given any chance at all, they would much rather flee than face the consequences. Unfortunately, copperheads have an attitude, and they are just as likely to face you down as they are to run away. I always give these neighbors a wide berth. Even the seemingly friendly possum has, on occasion, given me quite a start. I remember one night after dinner, I stepped outside for a smoke, and I heard something perched on the shelf I used to feed the cats. I turned to look and was face to face with a snarling possum. Inches from my nose, I was momentarily sure this menacing marsupial was about to leap on my head. I ran for my life, all willy-nilly into the yard, flailing my arms and making guttural sounds as I made my getaway. And never let us forget the nuisance raccoon. These are different from regular raccoons who go about their business in complete anonymity. It's the nuisance raccoon that menace your bird feeders at night and do the very best they can to eat your chickens. I thought about describing the activities of the mean and decidedly unfriendly ground bees, but you get the point. In Peaceful Valley, as much as we love living here, it's best to keep an ear out for things that go thump in the woods. This is Dave Seastrom, paying attention and staying out of the way. See you next time.
You've probably been told that Bear Wallow got its name from some hollowed-out places where bears used to wallow. Let me explain where it really comes from. A few generations back, the place didn't have a name. It was just a hilltop with a nice view where people sometimes went for a picnic. One year, on the first day of summer, the longest day, some young people chose that spot for a cookout and party. It was a hot day, and one of the boys decided to do something about it. He took off his clothes and sat down in a mud puddle left by a wagon, which had gotten off the road when the ground was soft. The recent rains had filled it with water. Some of the young ladies screamed. Some of them giggled. They all ran down the hill a short way so they could not see the bather. The fellers hooted and hollered and poked fun at him. He got tired of bathing after a while, and a couple of other fellers took turns at it. The hot weather had dampened the spirits of the group, but the nude bathing made the party come alive. Some say there were overly romantic happenings that took place, but I don't believe all those stories they tell. The next spring, the group began looking forward to another party on the hilltop. They planned to have it on graduation day, and the naked bathing would be featured. They dug out the hollow place so more people could bathe and hauled in water to make sure it was full. That year, all the fellers joined in for the naked bathing. One of them called it the Bear Wallow. It promised to be an annual event, and the place took on the name Bear Wallow, with the bear spelled B-A-R-E. The next year, the ladies joined in. Discreetly, of course. That was an even better party than the year before. The respectable people of the county learned about this. You know, the ones that join all those organizations. They held some meetings and did a lot of talking and decided to do something about the goings-on at Bear Wallow Hill. They went to the sheriff and told him they wanted it stopped. He said there wasn't any harm in what they were doing, and he didn't have any grounds for interfering with it. But one of the county commissioners spoke out and said he knew that the sheriff had gateways for dealing with irregularities in the law, and he could find a way to handle it. And so he did. The commissioners thought they would fill in the wallows, but they didn't have any money for that. The young people found other ways to entertain themselves at the start of summer. I won't talk about that, although it may have been even less respectable than the bear wallowing. But the hilltop was still called B-A-R-E Wallow, and there were signs along the road at the bottom of the hill with the name on them. After a couple of years, some people did not like the notoriety of that name and decided to change it. They dragged out some old stories of bears in Brown County and said that the wallows on the hilltop had been bear wallows. They had the road signs changed to say B-E-A-R instead of B-A-R-E. The only problem with that is that there weren't any bears in Brown County. There had been some years before, but not very many, because there are a lot of poor people in Brown County who could eat some bear meat. Now, over in Shelby County, there were a couple of youngsters who became expert at killing bears. A feller named Charlie Major wrote a book about them. They took advantage of their fame by going to all the nearby county fairs and telling stories about the bears they had killed. That feller named Major went along too and sold his books. Those boys had to maintain their reputation, and they kept after the bears till in a couple of years there weren't any left in Shelby County. So they moved over to Johnson County, but there weren't any trees large enough for a bear to sharpen his claws, so they went into Brown County. Before long, there weren't any bears left in Brown County either. Now, you may hear stories about how the bears made the wallows. That feller who calls himself Jacob Brown likes to tell about that. You don't need to dispute with the people who tell those tales. Just smile and feel very smug, because you know the truth about Bear Walla Hill, just like I done told you. This has been told by Keith Bradway.
Hi, this is Jeff Foster with the Brown County Hour, and today we're here with Ms. Carolyn Dutton, an extraordinary violinist who calls Brown County home now. Let's hear what Carolyn has to say about the violin.
It's nice to talk with you, Jeff. The violin, one of the questions I get asked by people is, what is the difference between a violin and a fiddle? They're both the same instrument. It's not in the body of the instrument that makes the difference. It's the sound that comes out of it. So, for example, if you're playing a classical piece, a piece by Bach or Beethoven or Brahms, you're playing it on a violin. But if you're playing a country tune, Irish tune, or a swing tune, or a jazz tune, or a blues tune, your violin becomes a fiddle because you made it that way. I like to play all different styles of music. I was taught classically, of course, when I began to play back in the fourth grade, I think it was. Went on to study classically during high school and college. And once I got out of college, I suddenly realized that I didn't want to play classical music. I wanted to play more popular musical forms. And I've had a great time throughout my life playing pretty much every different style that you can play on the instrument. And it's taken me very many fascinating places, and I've met a number of amazing musicians in every genre of music.
Playing here some what's commonly called gypsy jazz.
This style of music was created in France in the 1930s, and it was called gypsy jazz because Django Reinhardt was a gypsy. It was actually the swing and the jazz music created by European musicians in France during the 1930s who were fans of Duke Ellington and Benny Goodman and wanted to create their own special brand of European jazz. The Quintet of the Hot Club of France was Europe's first jazz combo, and it featured the gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt and the French violinist Stephan Grappelli. When I first became familiar with this group, of course I thought, oh, it's wonderful, it's Stephan Grappelli, it's all about the violin. And as I gradually researched it and over the years have listened to it, I realized that it's really Django Reinhardt who was the mastermind behind this group and on the specific style that they created, which is a swing style but it's played only by strings, and there aren't any drums, and there aren't any keyboards, and it's a kind of a unique style that I really enjoy playing.
Yeah, in his in the quintet, there was Django was on lead guitar most of the time, if not all the time.
All the time. There were three guitars, a bass, and a violin. So what did I say? That's 24 strings? How many? Let's see. 26 strings. Yeah. And that's all that was used to make the music. They created their own rhythm. It's a special thumping kind of rhythm called La Pompe by the French. The pump, I guess. A pump style rhythm. And Django had a very special way of playing, very percussive at times. The interesting thing about Django was that when he was a young man, he was caught in a fire which badly burned his left hand, so that he literally wound up only using two fingers and his thumb to play the guitar, and kind of recreated the whole way you approach the instrument and the way you form chords and the way you play scales. That accounts for the unusual sound that he has. But he also had a number of percussive things he did with his right hand. There's lots of banging and thumping, and very exciting. So it was really just swing music of the 30s in France, but it was called gypsy jazz because Django was a gypsy. And eventually it was picked up, not until the 70s or 80s, I guess, by a number of Western European, or rather Eastern Europeans, many of whom were gypsies, and they play today. They're even more amazing than the original quintet.
So now you're back in Brown County. Who's your favorite band to play with these days?
I can't imagine. Well, the... what's it called? Foster / Jones Band? I've been known to play with them when the opportunity presents itself, but I play with my own Django band called Blue Django. And we play all over the state.
And we're going to do a tune from them here.
Yes, we are. This was a show that we did up at Meridian Music back, 4 or 5 years ago, I think. And it was recorded live, so it's a live performance. And this particular song was a song written by Django Reinhardt, and I like it because it's kind of funny. And it's got two names. It's either called Double Whiskey or Scotch Whiskey, but either way, that's just fine, I think.
Right back after station identification. Welcome back to episode 18. In this segment, we have Gunther Flum, park naturalist Casey Norman, a discussion with Charlie Cole and Linda Baden about the Yellowwood Road project, and more music from Carolyn Dutton.
Take a bite out of crime. Now in the country, in the night, things appear, though out of sight. Things with stingers, teeth, and claw will in the night become the law. And every step that you may take or any sound that you might make, you will find and you will feel that in their court there's no appeal. You will find their juries in the night will scratch and sting and even bite. So in our woods and forest park, those critters come out after dark, things that slither, things that crawl, walk and run, and that ain't all. Some will jump or leap or fly that you can't see with naked eye. But you will know from deep within that something's there and on your skin. But you won't know what it could be because it's dark and you can't see. So where you go and what you bump might not be a rock or stump. We have spiders, snakes and rats, mosquitoes, ticks and rabid bats. Fox and coyote, bobcat too, will hunt at night outside your view. And up the path or down the trail in the night and without fail, you won't have to travel far and all of them know where you are. So you might think you're safe and sound, but in the country we have found that even if you build a fire, sometime you'll sleep and you'll retire, as under blanket there you lay, our country creature's night buffet. And so it is that where we're from, we find some folks are mighty dumb, for country people all take pity for our cousins from the city. It's true our critters, in the mood, might look at us like we was food, but in your city after dark, you have criminals in your park that you won't find we have out here because our country nights they fear. So come and visit, laugh and play, but make your journey in the day, and know at night there ain't no muggers. But do beware of our tree huggers, for you won't find we have much crime in our dark parks at dinner time.
Hi, I'm Cassie Norman from Brown County State Park Nature Center. I'm an interpretive naturalist and teach people about nature. Besides answering our most common question of, where's the restroom, we get asked a lot about snakes. People always want to know what kind of snake this is, if it's venomous, or what they should do with the snakes that they find, especially within the park. For those of you who do not know, we have timber rattlesnakes within the park, and they're nothing to be scared of. You just have to respect them, and they'll respect you. If you're out about in the park and you happen to come across a rattlesnake, just stay calm. Most likely, they'll hear you before you'll hear them, and they'll give you a rattle for a warning. If you hear this rattle, just step back, take your time, and let them go on their way. Now, if you're in the campground and you happen to come across a rattlesnake, you can always call the Nature Center or call the park security, and we will come remove it for you. Keep in mind that no visitor has been bitten by a timber rattlesnake within the last 30 years. I remember my first encounter with a timber rattlesnake was about 2 months ago. My first week working at the park, I was walking out to my car and saw a tail hanging out from underneath of it. I noticed the black tail and the rattle and right away knew that it was a timber rattlesnake. Immediately, I called Katie, one of our other naturalists, to ask what I should do. Still amazed that I had just seen one of these creatures, I grabbed my camera and took lots of pictures. Never once did it rattle, or coil up like it was going to strike me. It just went about its way back into the woods. It was then that I first discovered their docile temperament and could honestly say that if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone as well. Rattlesnakes are most active right now from July to August as they're searching for mates. Female rattlesnakes mature when they're about 5 to 6 years of age, then give birth every 3 to 5 years. Something that people don't know though is that rattlesnakes actually give live birth. Their eggs are developed inside of the female's body, hatched, and then 10 to 12 young crawl out to venture into the world. Brown County provides perfect habitat for rattlesnakes because of our hills and rocky outcrops that they hibernate in throughout the winter. Because their habitat is limited and people often want to kill venomous snakes, or any snake really, they're listed as an endangered species. We want to preserve their habitat and protect them, so it is illegal to kill a rattlesnake. In Indiana, there are over 30 species of snakes, but only 4 of these are venomous. In the northern part of the state, there are Massasauga rattlesnakes. Here within Brown County, there are copperheads and timber rattlesnakes, and farther south you can find cottonmouth snakes that some people refer to as water moccasins. Within Indiana, you can tell a venomous snake from a non-venomous snake from the shape of their head and their pupils. Venomous snakes have a triangular-shaped head to contain their venom glands, while non-venomous snakes have a more round-shaped head. Venomous snakes also have vertical pupils, while non-venomous snakes have round pupils, just like you and I. If you're brave enough to get close up to see their pupils anyway. If you're interested in learning more about rattlesnakes or any snake within the park, you can stop by the Nature Center and get an up-close look yourself. Maybe we can even ease your nerves a little when it comes to snakes. Again, this is Cassie Norman from Brown County State Park, Search Brown County State Park on Facebook to like our page, and you can look at our upcoming events or view our calendar on the web at interpretiveservices.in.gov. Thank you for listening.
Hey, Rick, you doing any good?
Nah, the only bites I'm getting are mosquitoes.
Yeah, me too. Pam, what about you?
I felt a few tugs, but nothing to write home about.
Maybe we should try some of that Gertie stink bait. That'll rouse them.
Man, I hate to turn that stuff loose. You remember what happened last time.
Well, that was pretty awful, but we're in a boat this time, and no one will be dragged into the water from shore.
Well, let's give it a try.
Wow, I didn't think they'd leap like that.
Yeah, I've never seen that before. Hey, wait a minute. Where's Dave? Dave?
Dave!
Dave! Dave!
So, are you guys gonna get me out of the water before this critter eats me, or what?
Hi, this is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and it's my privilege tonight to introduce our two guests who will be discussing the current situation on Yellowwood Road. Charlie Cole and his wife Linda Baden are with us this evening. Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us, now, Steve.
Shall we start with an overview of the current plan?
Sure. What we're talking about is a rebuilding and changing of the Yellowwood Lake Road that the DNR has proposed and that the DOT is planning to do. It's a project that will take place in two phases. The phase one will be south of the lake, phase two north of the lake. It's got a $6 million price tag on it. The original working price tag was $3.95 million. The $6 million price tag was announced at the recent meeting that was held at the junior high school in Brown County to talk about the road project. That was the first opportunity that most people had to give any input to the project, so which is one of the issues that we have with the way things have progressed with this project.
I know that you have been with the Watershed Group. Along the way, you've achieved some government grants. Would you like to talk about that and what was found out?
Sure. We were awarded two separate item watershed planning grants. Our group is called the Yellowwood Lake Watershed Planning Group, and we formed about 10 years ago. The first grant was to do a general plan for the Yellowwood Watershed, which is about 5,000 acres. That's the single largest contiguous plot of land in the Yellowwood State Forest system. So our first plan studied the watershed and all its different aspects and made a series of proposals. One of the main findings that we had was that the Yellowwood Lake was silting in very badly and that stream bed erosion was probably one of the causes for that. So we went back to IDEM with a second application for another planning grant that was dealing specifically with the stream bed and what's called natural stream restoration.
Who issued these grants?
It's the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. They're highly competitive, and we were lucky to get two. Usually a group is only awarded one watershed planning grant. And what that grant told us, the second grant, was that the stream beds are indeed highly erodible, that the stream is trying to find its natural flow, and it's being channelized by the road, and then that's the source of this vast amount of silt that was recently dredged out of Yellowwood Lake.
I assume you hired highly qualified professionals to do these studies.
Stantec from Louisville was the company involved.
They're a completely neutral scientific organization that just evaluates the facts without any bias one way or the other.
Yeah, they're technicians and scientists. They look at they have a study methodology that they used. Their specialty is what they call natural stream restoration. And what they try to do is they try to analyze the problems with a stream, figure out what they need to do to restore it to its natural flowage. And then they have all kinds of methodologies for doing that. So we were very hopeful that because of that study, we would be able to actually do some stream restoration. And they specifically designed the two creek crossings on Yellowwood Road as small projects that we could do. Small, still in the range of $250,000.
These studies are long concluded, and the information has been compiled. How much consideration did the DNR or NDOT give to these studies?
None. Zero.
Publicly, it's been stated that they did see these studies and cooperate. They didn't.
Did they share these studies with the council when they brought their original proposal before the county council?
What they told us, that we had two meetings with the DOT about the studies that we'd done and the possibility of them incorporating those studies into their Yellowwood Lake Road plans. And both times we were told, our job is to build roads, not to fix streams. We're not interested in hearing what you have to say, basically. Because the trouble with state government is it's so compartmentalized, nobody speaks to anybody else. And the DOT, the Department of Transportation, is at the top of the heap, and everybody kowtows to the DOT. So even though this is a DNR project funded with DNR funds, they have a special set-aside fund for access to recreational facilities. The DNR refused to back us up, back up the watershed group as far as asking them to incorporate some stream restoration into the plan.
They chose not to do this after a careful review of the plan?
We're not sure if they saw it or not.
We asked them lots of times to make sure that the right people saw it, that they reviewed it, that they understood it. We asked them to bring in a stream restoration team, or at least one person with some knowledge in stream restoration, and it just never happened.
Well, so who's designed this project?
It's Bernard and Lockmuller, who is the go-to consulting firm for DOT, which raises a whole other set of issues about why is this one firm always the ones that get these big.
Yeah, did they have to put a bid in?
I don't think they bid it, no. I don't think they do. They're the same firm that did I-69. So the outcome is that they proceeded basically with their plans with no stakeholder input and no public input. One thing that Charlie spearheaded was an attempt to use a process that our small watershed group uses, which is a lot of stakeholder input, getting all the opinions, reaching consensus over some whatever it is that we're discussing, and then moving forward. So what we offered to do as a watershed group was facilitate input into the road plan, that we would create meetings, we would gather the neighbors' opinions. We were neutral as far as how it would turn out, but we just felt it was essential that stakeholder input came in early, not after the fact. What NDOT likes to do is they like to design the project, then present it to the public, and only have you comment on environmental impacts. They want no input to the actual design of the project at all. They forced us into that narrow, narrow path, and the first time we were allowed to make any comment at all was at the meeting 2 weeks ago at the junior high school. So what we currently have is the multi-use path right now. People appreciate it for what it offers, not for the fact that it's not paved and they can't go fast down there. And what's interesting is you think the people that would be most interested in getting the road chip and sealed or paved or whatever, which are all the people that actually live on the road, to a person, they don't want it.
On Facebook.
Friends of Yellowwood. Yeah, on Facebook.
Excellent. So if people are interested, they can check in with that. Thank you very much. It's been a real privilege, and I'm glad to see you again.
Thank you for having us again.
And now, back to my interview with Carolyn Dutton.
Okay, let's go into the second tune, the McPike. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Treetops by Brent McPike. What's the backstory on that one?
Well, I live in Brown County in this, I guess you'd call it a subdivision, called Treetops. And over the past decade, I've worked with Brent McPike, who is a guitarist, got his doctorate at IU a few years ago, and teaches at Indiana State in Terre Haute. So Brent is a particular fan of the Django Gypsy Jazz style, and whenever we play that music in the Terre Haute area, we call it the Haute Club instead of the Hot Club. And Brent's a quite prolific composer, so he wrote a song for me called The Treetops, which features me on the violin.
Stay tuned for station identification. Welcome back to episode 18 of the Brown County Hour. We have Tramp Star, more music from Carolyn Dutton, folklorist John Kay, and local writer Peggy Daly.
Hi, I'm Tramp Star. You don't know about me without you've read the writings of a fellow named Carl Wilson, but that ain't no matter. Carl was a writer, a goat farmer, a boxer, and an all-around swell guy. Good friend of mine. Well, back in the day, old Carl Wilson used to write up some stuff about the county life, such as we used to live here in Brown County, and he'd send it in along with one of my poems up to the Indianapolis Star newspaper, and it would appear in the Sunday edition right beside Frank Hohenberger's Sunday story, Down in the Hills of Brown. I reckon Carl got paid some little something on the whole deal, but I never did see a penny of that money. Carl would publish my stuff under the title Jokes and Jingles from Curly Shingles by Tramp Star. Curly Shingles was the name he had given his little old cabin. The shake shingles had all kind of curled up on him. Tramp Star's, well, that's me. Wilson's Barn. There never was such a place to play as Wilson's Barn on a rainy day. Remember the high knoll where it stood, how the kids from the neighborhood would come piling in from everywhere when sudden rain stabbed the summer air? Could see the Smiths and the Joneses tribe come lickety-brindle side by side, and crowding their heels would be the four O'Briens, a-tearing for the door, and then the Adams twins. And coming slow, with his everlasting bunged-up toe and pale hair stuck through his straw hat crown, was the preacher's kid. Worst boy in town, all scootin' to Wilson's barn to play when rain thumped down on a summer day. Nowhere on earth such a place to play as Wilson's barn on a rainy day, bulging with hay to its high old walls, dotted with mangers and cribs and stalls and fodder and corn and a bin of wheat, yellow and cool to our hot bare feet. A carryall and an old bobsled and a dangling hay rope overhead where the Adams kid, born acrobat, would swing far out as he skunned the cat. Oh, the games of tag and hide and seek and the row of cattle, mild and meek, and the pinto colt that rolled his eyes in alarmed and comical surprise when we piled in Wilson's barn to play and rain swept down on a summer day. Oh, never was such a place, I say, as Wilson's barn on a rainy day. But folks grow old and their youthful friends drift off like waves that a pebble sends. But drifting leave us a thought of him, as kind and dear as a man's own kin. And they take, I hope, the selfsame joy in their thought of me, the preacher's boy. But I have a wish, and here it is, that the Smiths and the Joneses and the Adamses, wherever they chance to be today, may know one-tenth of the ecstasy, the day-long joy, and the dreamless sleep that only our youth could hold and keep when we raced to Wilson's barn to play and rain drummed down on a summer day.
And now, back to my interview with Carolyn Dutton.
Carolyn, you're featured on a tune by Monica Herzig called Olay. Tell us about that.
Monica, I'm sure many of the listeners will be aware of her. She's a very fine jazz pianist and teacher and performer. She performs all over the place, all over the state, and also all over the country. And this is an original composition by her She has a group that she calls the Monica Herzig Acoustic Project. So I'm kind of a member of that now. The membership varies. It usually consists of piano and bass and drums and a sax and maybe me or a singer sometimes. So she makes an album almost every year, and this is from her album called Come With Me, which she made several years ago. And it's quite a flashy Latin number. Thank you.
Carolyn Dutton, thank you so much for being with us on the Brown County Hour.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We finally reached those hot days of summer, and it makes me think of James Whitcomb Riley's poem, August. August, a day of torpor in the sullen heat of summer's passion. In the sluggish stream, the panting cattle lave their lazy feet with drowsy eyes and dream. Long since the winds have died, and in the sky there lives no cloud to hint of nature's grief. The sun glares ever like an evil eye, and withers flower and leaf. Upon the gleaming harvest field remote, the thresher lies deserted, like some old dismantled galleon that hangs afloat upon a sea of gold. A yearling cry of some bewildered bird above an empty nest, and truant boys along the river's shady margin heard a harmony of noise, a melody of wrangling voices blent with liquid laughter and rippling calls of piping lips and thrilling echoes sent to mimic waterfalls. And through the hazy veil the atmosphere is draped about the gleaming face of day, and sifted glances of the sun appear in splinterings of spray. The dusty highway, like a cloud of dawn, trail o'er the hill, and the passerby, a tired ghost in misty shroud, toils on his journey to the sky. And down across the valley's drooping sweep, withdrawn to farthest limit of the glade, forest stands in silence, drinking deep its purple wine of shade. The gossamer floats up on phantom wing, the sailor's vision voyages the sky and carries into chaos everything that freights the weary eyes, till throbbing on and on the pulse of heat increases, reaches, passes fever height, and day sinks into slumber, cool and sweet, within the arms of night. Beautiful poem by James Whitcomb Riley, and I hope you all can brave the heat and open up the windows in the evening time and let the cool winds from Brown County cool you down a little bit.
I had gone to work at a bait shop at 5:30 a.m. as usual on Saturday, leaving husband number 3 and my son in a house all snug in bed. There was a crappie tournament this weekend, and we were going to be busy. My boss had saved my favorite job for me, doing the worms. He had gone and gotten the minnows and the beemaws the night before and taken care of them, so I got the night crawlers, jumpers, and redworms. They were done in a couple hours between early customers, and I was restocking the shelves when I noticed we had only 1 9-inch orange and white river bobber left in the store. When I asked my boss about more, he said that we did not want any more ordered because they were poor sellers. They were $5. He put a half price sign on it, so I bought it. Always need another bobber. My son and husband number 3 came in and got supplies to go to the tournament and asked me to join them after I got off at 2 p.m. They put my tackle in the car for me and left, so I was going to try my new bobber. After work, I got as close to where they were going to be as possible, on the bank by the parking lot, and set up for the afternoon after leaving a note to tell them where I would be on their car. I rigged up my poles, and the catfish pole had my new bobber. So it was all my poles out, and I was watching, and my new bobber was dancing a lot, more than the others, but all I could see was a turtle playing with it. And I did not want to catch a turtle, So I reeled it in and put it way out on the other side. About 5 minutes later, the turtle was there again, dancing with my bobber. I reeled it in and moved it again, and here came the turtle. I reeled it in and removed the hook and the bait and secured the bobber so I would not lose it, but would not hook the turtle, thinking it would go away with no bait to play with. Knowing I would not hook him, I just let him play for about a half an hour or so. He stayed right there when I moved the bobber to the other side and closer to the bank, and here he came. I took it out of the water and left it lying on the bank while I took care of the other poles and business. Took a walk to the potty palace and back, and there was the turtle on the bank sitting on my bobber. He was very upset with my return and challenged me at first. So I sat on a rock and watched for a while, and it definitely love at first sight. I felt betrayed. The bobber I loved was having a turtle affair. From first cast, too. But I had two other poles I had to take care of. After getting the poles safely out of the turtle's territory, I reeled in and put them up. I was worried about how to get my turtle protected pole. So with a stick and some strange tactics, I finally got a hold of it and cut the bobber from the line, let it drop as close as possible to the turtle. After about an hour, the turtle realized bobber was a free agent and worked it into the water. And I hope they will live happily ever after and not just be one night affair, although you never know, it might have been up to the bobber after all. My name is Peggy Daly, and that is my turtle story.
So, Peggy, which bait shop did you work in?
I worked for John Adams when his bait shop used to be across from the west gate of the state park.
So, I'm curious, the worms, they arrive in a huge container, and you got to count out a dozen for each little box.
They come in a 12-inch by 12-inch box with 1,000 in them, and you got to put them.
1,000 eager worms that want a little more space. What is the title?
Practical Woman's Guide to Fishing. It takes them from finding a fishing pole, cleaning it up, and catching and cleaning and cooking. My book was written so that women could go fishing with men and not interfere with men.
You mentioned husband number three several times. Is there husband number four or?
There was husband number five.
Is that right?
I've been married five times. I gave up the hobby.
You just gave it up then?
Yes.
But you still fish then?
Yes, when I have a chance.
So the husbands are gone, but fishing endures.
Oh, yeah.
So Peggy, this book, Practical Woman's Guide to Fishing, where can we get it?
The Book Loft has some. Nashville IGA has them. The Gatesville store has them. And I think you can still get it on Kindle.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to episode 18 of the Brown County Hour in our new time slot. Be sure to join us the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m.
Be sure to log on to our website, browncountyhour.com, and our Facebook page. You can stream any of our episodes on our website, browncountyhour.com, or wfhb.org. With this as our first monthly show on Sunday mornings, we're particularly interested in your feedback, ideas, and contributions.
The Brown County Hour originates from our studio in the Traditional Arts Building in Nashville, Indiana.
Produced by Jeff Foster and Pam Rader, co-produced by Rick Fettig, Vera Grubbs, Janice Pierce, and Dave Seastrom. Executive producer for WFHB is Allison Bechtesh.
And thanks to Slats Glue for our theme music. You've been listening to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back. back to my old Brown County home.